This is Ned Ryan, and welcome to the History of the Constitutional Convention, Episode 5. Last week, I discussed James Madison's role in the Constitutional Convention, and I left off about the time Madison entered a newly formed House of Representatives. I want to pick up with today's podcast at an important point during Madison's first term in Congress. During the constitutional ratification battles, there was something of a compromise reached with the Anti-Federalists, chief among them Patrick Henry. If a Bill of Rights would be attached to the Constitution, they would not fight against the Constitution and would accept it as legitimate. Initially, Madison, and I quote, adamantly maintained that a specific Bill of Rights remained unnecessary because the Constitution itself was a Bill of Rights. Madison had three main objections to a specific Bill of Rights. A. It was unnecessary, since it purported to protect against powers that the federal government had not been granted. B. It was dangerous, since enumeration of some rights might be taken to imply the absence of other rights. And C. At the state level, bills of rights had proven to be useless paper barriers against government powers, with Madison and Roger Sherman of Connecticut being the other two members of the committee. There would be 10 amendments that would form our Bill of Rights. Contrary to Madison's wishes, the Bill of Rights was not integrated into the main body of the Constitution, and it did not apply to the states until the passage of the 14th and 15th Amendments, which restricted the powers of the states. Now, something interesting takes place during Madison's time in Congress. Remember, he was a chief advocate for calling for a new national government that took the power out of the state legislature's hands. But during his time in Congress, Madison worked tirelessly to limit the power of the federal government. Some argue that Madison never wanted a national government that took an active role, and that he was horrified that his chief allies in calling for this constitution, Hamilton and Washington, were creating a real modern European type of government with a bureaucracy, a standing army, and a powerful independent executive. Now the Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, began building a nationwide network of supporters that would eventually become the Federalist Party, which promoted a strong central government with a national bank. Madison, his former ally, would have none of it, and with Jefferson, organized the Democratic Republican Party. Madison led the unsuccessful attempt to block Hamilton's proposed Bank of the United States, arguing that the new Constitution did not explicitly allow the federal government to form a bank. This is a fascinating change between Madison and Hamilton. Here were two friends who had been successful in calling for a new form of government, had written the Federalist Papers together, but were now adamantly opposed to each other on how this new form of government should work. And not only did Madison find himself opposing Hamilton, he found himself opposing Washington. Madison usually lost these battles with Hamilton and Washington, whether it was over the National Bank or the controversial Jay Treaty. Madison's politics would remain closely aligned with Jefferson's until the experience of a weak national government during the War of 1812 caused Madison to appreciate the need for a strong central government to aid national defense. He then began to support a national bank, a stronger navy, and a standing army. When Jefferson won the bitter presidential election of 1800 over John Adams, he selected Madison as his Secretary of State. The greatest challenge Madison would face as secretary was navigating between the two great superpowers of the day, Britain and France, who were almost constantly at war with each other during this time. Of course, this seemingly eternal conflict between France and Britain would play into Jefferson and Madison's hands in 1803, when Napoleon realized he could not defend France's holdings in America. And he also realized it was to France's advantage that Britain did not seize those lands. Madison and Jefferson would reverse party policy and negotiate for the Louisiana Purchase, and then win congressional approval for that deal. Madison's time as secretary was for the most part a successful run, as he threaded the needle between England and France. But he and Jefferson would make a major misstep with their embargo, which forbid Americans to trade with any foreign nation. The embargo failed as foreign policy and instead caused massive hardships in the southern seaboard, which depended on foreign trade. In 1808, Madison was selected by the Democrat Republicans to be their nominee, and he would win in convincing fashion over Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of the Federalists, who was a fellow signer of the Constitution. Madison would serve two terms as president, but I don't want to touch too much on the details of his presidency. That's for someone else at another time. When Madison left office in 1817, he retired to Montpelier, his tobacco plantation in Virginia, not far from Jefferson's Monticello. Madison was then 65 years old. He left the White House significantly poorer than when he had entered it. Some think that because of his financial difficulties, he refused to allow his notes on the Constitutional Convention, or its official records which he possessed, to be published in his lifetime. Quote, he knew the value of his notes and wanted to bring money to his estate for Dolly's use as his plantation failed. He was hoping for $100,000 from the sale of his papers, of which the notes were the real gem. End of quote. Madison's financial troubles and his deteriorating mental and physical health would continue to consume him. In 1829, at the age of 78, Madison was chosen as a representative to the Constitutional Convention in Richmond for the revising of the Virginia State Constitution. This was to be Madison's last appearance as a legislator and a constitutional draftsman. The issue of greatest importance at this convention was apportionment. The western districts of Virginia complained that they were underrepresented because the state constitution apportioned voting districts by population, and the count included slaves, even though slaves could not vote. The westerners had few slaves, while the eastern planters had many, and thus the vote of a white easterner outweighed the vote of a white westerner. Madison, who in his prime was known as the great legislator, tried to effect a compromise, such as the 3/5 ratio for slaves that was used by the U.S. Constitution, but it was to no avail. Eventually, the eastern planters prevailed in this argument, and slaves would continue to be counted towards their masters' districts. Madison was crushed at the failure of Virginians to resolve this issue more equitably. Quote, the convention of 1829 pushed Madison steadily to the brink of self-delusion, if not despair. The dilemma of slavery undid him. End of quote. Madison lived on until 1836, increasingly ignored by the new leaders of the American polity. He died at Mount Pelier on June 28th, the last remaining signer of the United States Constitution. There are literally thousands of pages written about James Madison's work and his life. This podcast was meant more to highlight Madison, his connection to the Constitution, and his importance to America. He died uncertain as to what his legacy would be. But as historian Gary Wills wrote, Madison's claim on our admiration does not rest on a perfect consistency any more than it rests on his presidency. He has other virtues. As a framer and defender of the Constitution, he had no peer. The finest part of Madison's performance as president was his concern for the preserving of the Constitution. No man could do everything for the country, not even Washington. Madison did more than most, and did some things better than any. And that was quite enough. In next week's podcast, I want to talk about another important event on the road to Philadelphia, Shays' Rebellion.